everybody. This is Gijamina. I'm here with Real Talk, Our Journey. I'm excited for today's episode. And even more exciting is that I have Tiffany with me today as my co-host. How are you, Tiffany?
I'm doing well, Gigi. I'm so glad you invited me back.
Yes. For those that did not know, Tiffany was a guest on our previous episode where we celebrated Women's History Month. And we wanted to highlight local women who have done an amazing impact in the community. And Tiffany was one of those wonderful women that we highlighted. So thank you for that. If you have not listened to that episode, we are on Spotify, Buzzsprout, and Apple. So I would definitely check it out and hear about all the wonderful work that Tiffany has done and still is doing. So Tiffany, thank you for joining me as a co-host. It's a little bit of a difference, right?
It is, and I'm super excited. I just think this podcast is doing wonders and elevating the voices of women near and far, and to be invited back to talk about someone or have someone on that I think has an amazing story to share. It's just really, really a treasure. So thanks for having me on again.
Absolutely. And Tiffany, thank you. You are a strong educator and advocate for women and girls. So it's wonderful that you are the vice chair for the board of the Fund for Women and Girls.
Yes, I am so proud to be vice chair of that board. That organization is doing phenomenal work for dozens of nonprofits in our area, really expanding the work of and the outreach and impact of women and girls in our area, whether that's through education, healthcare, domestic violence, whatever it might be, social, emotional things. We're definitely working towards elevating every woman and girl in our area. And I'm so glad I get to be a part of that.
Yes, that's amazing. And I'm so glad that we got connected in the last episode. And here we are again today, bringing another dynamic woman into the fold. So our special guest for today is Kim Andrews, who is the new executive director for the Fund for Women and Girls. And she has an amazing story she would love to share about where she was, everything that she has gone through in her journey, and where she is today.
Kim is just an amazing woman who has an amazing story to share. She is strong. She is committed. She knows the power of community and how it can uplift and transform lives. And I'm really glad to have a woman like her taking the helm as the executive director for the Fund for Women and Girls.
So Kim Andrews, welcome to the episode, and we're excited to hear your story.
Thanks, Gigi. I'm so happy to be here, and I'm really excited. I've just started at the Fund about almost a month ago, almost 4 weeks ago. And I've been worked in nonprofits for years, but to have the opportunity to advance women and girls and support advocacy around that is so exciting for me. It's I've realized it's kind of come together from all of my experiences, something that I'm very passionate about. So I'm the executive director of the Fund for Women and Girls, but my story starts. I was a little middle class kid in Mount Airy. I grew up in Philadelphia in a happy two parent household, kind of running the streets in the 70s, like all the little kids did back then. And we moved to the suburbs at some point when I was in fourth grade, and things were very different there. I felt there was much, I grew up in a neighborhood that was really diverse, economic, racial, religious diversity, moving to a very, very white area. So it was a very strange, strange change for me. And it really put me off. And I never really fit into that environment, actually. But along the way, I was kind of lonely. I didn't have many friends. And I met in high school this very aggressive and charming boy who subsequently became my husband eventually after many years. But I mean, my story really revolves around kind of mental illness and abuse and alcoholism, and then the recovery from all of that on my part. So we were dating, and he was very stalky, which should have been a red flag, things that you know now. And some of it is the way life goes, that people, I felt like I didn't have information that would have been helpful to know back when I was a teenager around what's a healthy relationship between a man and a woman or between two partners. So we had lots of fun. He was from a very wealthy family. So we, on his parents' dime, we traveled here and there. We lived in Central America. We got married. We broke up, but then we got married because he kind of stalked me until I was like, well, okay, sure, why not? These are all red flags.
I think sometimes everyone, we see them as red flags, I think now, which I'm glad that you're sharing this, but I think in the moment and sometimes with what society puts out there, it's just, he was very interested in you and he knew you were the one. I think that's that spin that they sometimes put. So thank you again for sharing. I will sit quietly and let you continue.
Oh, no. Well, it's like the love bombing, as there's a name right. for it now. Like, oh, he got me flowers. He got me perfume. And I was just from this very provincial little family. So it was really exciting. So we eventually got married. And there were two things that kind of happened simultaneously in those early years. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I don't think I even shared that part of my story. I've been sober for over 25 years now. And so my alcoholism was kind of kicking up. And then it turned out that he had serious mental illness that started, and like in many people, manifesting itself in our early 20s and into our late 20s. But we got married when we were 23, so there wasn't much time for either of us to look at or to deal with that. So we went on. I had three kids, and his mental illness became worse and worse. He, you know, from the outside, we looked like we had a night, well, we did. It was, you know, we had a decent little modest house, and he actually went to law school. He had a hard time finishing. He never passed the bar because his mental illness was just like out of control at that point. And so it's kind of like the simile of being a frog in a pan of cool water, where you put the frog in the pan of cool water and it just sits there and you turn the heat on and it takes a real long time before you notice that it's real hot. So our relationship was, there were abusive parts to it from very early on, but I didn't really recognize that again. And so it got to the point of we had three kids. I was right after I had my third daughter, I wasn't working because I couldn't. I was a picture framer. I had been working in our basement as a picture framer, and I made a little bit of money. He was barely working at all at that point. But a good friend of mine, and I was going to AA regularly. I'd gotten sober at that point, talking about how women help each other and how single women help each other or women in trouble help each other. A friend of mine who didn't have much money, I would drive her to AA meetings with a good friend. She saved up $200 out of her money and gave it to me so that I could buy shelving and tables for my basement so I could start my business so that I had money because I didn't have my own money at that point. And so yeah. This friend of mine who she just saw I was in trouble and she gave me $200. And it's a lot of money, but it's a little money, but it changed everything because I could start working then and I could see how I could be autonomous and how would I go forward. I always felt like I was a smart person, but I graduated from college. I had thought I was going to be an art history professor. That was my fancy pants dream. And I just bagged out of it time and again. I applied to graduate schools and I was accepted to a number of them. I was offered a full ride to Brown University and I was so afraid. I was, my early years were like change I was afraid of. And I never even replied to them. They offered me a full ride. I didn't know how I would move there. I didn't know how I would get an apartment. I didn't know what to do about my boyfriend who was about to become my husband. And so I left. You know, that was an example of a big opportunity I just left behind out of fear, out of kind of like being kind of too enmeshed with my ex-husband and then not knowing. No one in my family had ever gotten a graduate degree. It would make me different than everybody. So I just didn't follow it. It's
right.
You know, and that's what with my own children and other people I know, it's like there's those points where you make choices and you're definitely making the worst choice for yourself and how to like advocate for yourself and think of what the right choice is. But, eventually our marriage just descended into nonstop abuse. He couldn't work anymore. We were so poor. I mean, we had the revenue we had was from my my picture framing, which I couldn't really do much of because I didn't have much childcare, even though it was at home. It was just barely enough to get by until then there was one day and he stopped working entirely. There was one day where he had been, it was very abusive, threatening me verbally, physically, assaulting me. And I mean, and I'm going to say this is very, it still tears me up. Is that the thing that he would tell me all the time was that I was ugly, lazy, fat, and stupid. Those four words, ugly, lazy, fat, wow. and stupid. And it got into me so much. It took me so many years to not think of myself as ugly, lazy, fat, and stupid. And objectively, I can say, I'm not ugly. I'm not lazy. I'm not fat or stupid. I'm kind of the opposite of all those. Like, I'm smart. I work hard. But in an abusive situation, your confidence just gets destroyed. And right. An example of somebody just purposely trying to destroy the confidence of another person. So there was one day where I called the police and the police came and it was a horrible scene and he's screaming. And that day wasn't worse than any other day, but the police came, made him leave. And then I didn't let him back. And that was like, obviously the shift point of where now I'm better off without him, having to make that decision. When are you better off without a person? And now I have three kids and I have to support them. So I had shortly before that, realizing there was a crisis, I had gotten a job in Center City, Philadelphia. So I had to take the train to work every day. It was when my youngest was in kindergarten because childcare, you know, the terror of childcare. How do you have a job and go to it every single day? What if, you know, what if your bus is late? What if your kids get out of school? So my mom helped me a lot with that. But it was really the path to kind of another life. It was working with people who didn't really know anything about my background. They respected me. They knew what I was capable of. And I was able to start working in that, you know, in that environment. And it changed my life. They gave me the strength to kind of persevere because I had protection from abuse orders. And this is another, you know, time in my life where women I knew just helped me. It was surprising to me when the police, I call it the day the police came, when the police came, how friends of ours dropped us, how friends of my kids' parents, they didn't really want their kids to be involved with, I mean, not even like weird violent scenes with a family that was in distress. So I had, there were a lot of repercussions for my kids, and it showed me, it really kind of made me a little more cynical, but it also made me hopeful because, well, a number of people dropped us, my network of women friends and honestly, single parent women friends were the ones that sustained me. We helped each other. And I lived in a very racially diverse neighborhood. And quite honestly, it was the other single women that I was friends with in the neighborhood were mostly women of color, were Black or Mexican descent. And we looked out for each other. If someone didn't have bus fare, we'd give each other a little bit of money here or there. We'd watch each other's kids. It was eye-opening. And then going into the schools, you know, having to, it was surprising to me how I needed to tell my kids' teachers that something had happened. And the teachers were, as a, you know, I'm a white woman, and I've really gotten a lot of privilege from that. And the teachers honestly treated me and my kids differently than they did many of my friends who were women of color. With the, you know, like I had a sad story and they had a story that was just, you know, what they would have expected. So it was a cynical making in the sense that, like, wow, this is seeing things that are wrong that are happening, seeing people who drop me, seeing the people that I care about the most being treated poorly, but knowing that people really came together to support me and then I was able to reciprocate. So around that time, I was like, great, I'm making $24,000 a year working full time. my kids and I, we had that, you know, that's very little money for four people, as everybody on this podcast knows. They were getting free lunch. They were on Medicaid. We had live heat. My power would get turned off. We'd ran out of heat. I'm a big football fan. I watched the Eagles Super Bowl bid in 2015 with no heat, like memories that you have. And they lost too. So that made it even worse. So about this time, I was like, how am I going to get myself out of this? I have three kids to support. And I made a list of like, what can I do? And I was like, well, and I wrote out, I need to get a master's degree and I need to get a better job. I need to, you know, what I want to do. I want to become an executive director of a historic site or a history museum. And then I want to work at a foundation. And so I kind of laid out those steps. And from today, it's amazing. I've actually achieved each of those things, but one by one, it was so difficult along the way. And I had the support of so many people. So the first step was inside my office, there was a job position that opened up and it required a master's degree, which I didn't have. And I went to them. I made the case that I should have that job and that I would get a master's degree. And so I quick found a really impressive online master's degree program out of England, of all places. And here's a pro tip. English, even online, because in other countries, they actually fund higher education. It costs $13,000 for the whole master's degree. So I got this very highly. Yeah.
And sorry, that was That is surprising with everything going on with education right now and kids so much, young adults fearing to go to school because of the debt that they will incur or going so far and then not returning because of that.
Yeah, it's brutal. And I mean, some fields, like I worked in arts and culture for many years, and you need a master's degree to get advanced positions. And I find it ridiculous. A master's degree proves that you had the money and, you know, the attention for 2 years to get a master's degree. It doesn't prove better work or more capacity or, you know, more creative thinking. It doesn't prove anything except you had money and you had time. but it's a requirement. So I talked to my parents. They paid for that master's degree, thank God, outright. They didn't have a ton of money, but they you know, I laid out my path for myself. And then I spent 2 years studying for this master's degree. I got the internal job on the promise that I'd get the master's degree, and it was a big jump. Ultimately, it almost doubled my salary by the time I left that job, but it put me on the path of like having a master's degree. And so the points for me that I keep, that I've always seen along the way, and it continues, is like an opportunity, something comes up. And I've had to, rarely does an opportunity come up where it's just like perfect and right in front of you. But for me, I've seen these points where an opportunity comes up. And if I have the support of the people around me, if I can think creatively on how to pursue it, then it's worked out for me. And usually, mm-hmm. I mean, if I work real hard, but I also don't want to work too hard. So if I'm banging my head against, I don't want to keep banging my head against walls. Let's put it that way.
Right.
So like looking for an opportunity that I can walk into and I can do. So I was able to, I got the elevation of my position and I got my master's degree, which again changed everything. But along the way, I did have a support of the people I was working with now, who they got to hear the very difficult times of the protection from abuse order. And they had to look out for my ex-husband coming to my office and, you know, all those fun things that as, you know, if you want to be seen as like a strong and autonomous woman, but if somebody's looking for you, you got to tell people so that they can help you. And it's embarrassing. I mean, that's the thing, is that some of this stuff with some of my groups, it was, you know, it's embarrassing to tell these things. Others, the women, my supports, they had similar experiences, or we had all seen other women we knew who had these experiences. And I think a lot of people, like some of those friends of my kids, they just wanted to live in purposeful blindness to other people's hardships. They didn't want to see right. it. They didn't want to hear about it. They didn't want to have to deal with it. They wanted to pretend it wasn't there. And again, that made me a little cynical, but very hopeful at the same time. So I actually went on, and my kids have two out of three have graduated from college. My son went into the Army. They had to be very independent very early on, as we all know. My kids started working as soon as they could. They walked to a fantastic day camp, Serendipity Day Camp in Ardmore from our house. And we had it was like the 70s, where we had these giant groups of kids from our middle class neighborhood, working class neighborhood, walking to day camp together because all of we moms were working. So we all had to go to work. So at 8:30, all the kids walked over and they'd all walk back. It's like the 70s. But they looked out for each other. And then the moms that were around looked out for those kids. And so they my kids have a great sense of autonomy, that they can take care of themselves, you know, things that they definitely have sadness in their hearts. Their father ditched, actually, thank God, nobody's seen him in these parts for many, many years. He's one of Pennsylvania's biggest deadbeat dads. But the peace of mind of him not being around, it was actually great. Normally I wouldn't say that, but this was a pretty extreme situation. Right. And then I was able to become an executive director of a historic site, just like I dreamed. I got turned down from several because I didn't have any experience. And so I found one that was desperate enough to hire me. And I was super successful. And then, you know, when it came time to make another change, I actually have that list. And I've looked at it periodically, like a foundation. I said, I want to go to a foundation and do things differently. And then finding the fund for women and girls, where throughout my life I've been advancing women and girls professionally, you know, and with my friends and colleagues, my children's friends, and now I have an opportunity to actually affect change and give back all the people along the way who pushed me along. Who I had a friend who she would take me and my kids to Old Navy. She had a lot more money than me. She was retired once a year. So they would get school clothes because we were getting free groceries. You know, I was getting bags of, you know, the world of hand-me-downs where you just move the hand-me-downs around from in our neighborhood. It was like single mom to single mom, just trash bags moving around as kids get older and bigger. And it's like, then you put the old stuff in the bag and you move it to the next house and so on and so forth. So there were just so many people along the way who helped me and supported me. And now, you know, besides just the ad hoc helping and supporting people along the way, it's like I can professionally actually do something. And my special skill is executive directing, which sounds ridiculous, but I can organize things and I can raise money. And then I can help that money get to the smaller nonprofits that provide services for women and girls around education, domestic violence, social services, and athletics, which I was a big sporty kid. So it's so exciting to be in this position now. I can't even believe that my life has come this far, but it, you know, those opportunities along the way and that support are what got me here. I know that it wasn't me, that I was very fortunate. I came from a stable family, which helped me a lot, but wow.
Right.
It's amazing to be here today. And I'm just so grateful for my life today and grateful for the people that I know.
Thank you for sharing from the beginning to where you are now, the obstacles and what you may have encountered, but how you built. One of the main things I keep hearing is you built a really strong support system with friends and family that you had around to help you and your kids, which is great. And that kind of, you know, helped push you to the next level for you to reach those goals. And it definitely sounds like your kids got a very strong support system and friends as well through this journey, but also a really strong work ethic and independence from it. So I wanted to open it up to, I didn't know if Tiffany had any questions to ask. I didn't want to ask away without giving you an opportunity.
Oh, no. I mean, I'm definitely going to piggyback off of what you said, Gigi. This whole idea of community seemed to pop up after the situation. So I was just curious about what was your community like when you were going through what you were going through? Did you have family, friends, a support network that you felt safe enough to share these things with? Or did you feel like you were going to be ostracized or people were just going to kind of tell you to push it under the rug? Because I do think as someone who lives in this area that we're in, there is some type of feeling ostracized when you're not that idyllic family, when you don't have the parents are divorced. You know, I'm in that same situation. I'm a divorced mom, single mom, and it almost feels as if I have like a scarlet letter sometimes. And it's like, I'm still a human. I'm still a person. I still have, you know, great things to offer the world. I'm still a great parent. Like none of those things are still not true just because a relationship in my life ended. So.
Well, and that's what, you know, certainly in those, when all the abuse was happening through me having my three kids, which was of course, as we all like getting worse and worse and worse, progressively worse. It wasn't just stable. My ex-husband was kind of an asshole. So, he was alienating many of my family. It, you know, he was working to kind of separate. And so I had a close enough relationship, but I was not very honest with my family. I didn't trust or believe that they could help me. They didn't have any knowledge or experience on how to handle a difficult situation. Honestly, kind of very naive. And the one person in my family that helped me is my cousin, Kate, who's, you know, she's one of my best friends. She helped me through this as a family member. She's the one who helped me the most. My sisters, who I love dearly and I'm very close to, you know, they had been kind of put off by my ex-husband's behavior. And honestly, he was kind of threatening to, he would, you know, if your sister comes back here with her husband, I'm going to beat them up. I don't want them around here, where he would like threaten family members to me. So like, that's different. So then it became even more imperative that I lived in a close neighborhood. It was an Ardmore neighborhood. So we were actually very close to each other, but, right. Close knit, so that those are the people who saw what would happen. They could hear him yelling. They knew that there was danger in my house. They could see my kids playing and knew what I was trying to do. And so it was the closest people that floated up were the people who were physically closest to me. And I'm, I don't know what it would have been like if I had been in like more of a far-flung suburban environment where the houses are apart and you don't really know each other, because my neighbor across the street, who, you know, the joke was she would like peer out her window anytime something happened. She, that the first year after the police came, she and her family, they gave me $400. And then they were a secret Santa that for 12 days before Christmas, they put out little treats anonymous for and like quizzes and things for my kids. So she did that, you know, in a way that people who honestly you would think would be closer couldn't, that the physical proximity made it a much deeper connection. And that, you know, those physically close people were the ones that saved me.
That's great. I also wanted to mention, one of the things that you said is when you got the job, you mentioned the words that he used that definitely broke your confidence. But when you were able to start working, that shift that happened in you, because you started to see a difference and started to believe, but also because you were somewhere where people didn't know your story. So you were able to come to them free in yourself and build your reputation and who you are. So that was something that stood out to me in your story. And definitely, I'm sure there's a lot of individuals that can relate to that. You know, as you're moving along your journey, things may happen, but knowing that you can stay true to you and build your confidence and believe in yourself, and then build that support around you to keep going. I started off wanting to be Supreme Court judge, not there, things happen, but I love the work that I do. So I feel I am where I'm supposed to be right now today. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the big mindset for individuals. I think sometimes we get caught up in comparing ourselves to others and where others are as to where we are, and what we've gone through in life will definitely change our path and our journey. But where you are today is where you need to be today, is something I always try to tell my kids. So.
That's so true. And actually, I missed the part where I got sober. After I had my son, I got sober. And that was my journey in sobriety helped me kind of get out of, it kind of gave me a fast start, I should say, to getting out of believing that I was ugly, lazy, fat, and stupid. Because so much, you know, one of the things that's always, you know, we're our own worst enemies. oh no, things are going badly because I'm bad, because right. I suck. And it was almost like having, it was a way to talk over, but again, having all these other friends too, it took me many years to even tell anybody that's what he called me. Cause it just made such shame that I'm a strong person. I do so many things. Why would I accept that kind of behavior? How could I have been in a long-term relationship with so much of that? But getting out of that and having kind of the objective voice in my head that, you know, until recently, if something went wrong, it was like, oh, it's because I'm stupid. Oh, I didn't do it because I'm lazy. But now I kind of have the objective voice like, that's ridiculous. You're not lazy. You are busy. You are doing so many things. That's not lazy. That's busy. Like stupid. You're not stupid. You're doing all these complicated things. One thing didn't happen. And so, you know, to kind of talk back to my own self about worse than criticism, like insults, character assassination that I really absorbed has been, you know, really important for me too. But it took me, and I know many other people do, it gets filled with such shame around having accepted something, but you know, there's only one way out, and that's to go forward and, you know, and just make the best of it and, you know, help other people and try to be able to accept the help that's offered.
Right. Thank you for that.
So you talked about being with your spouse from a young age and kind of growing into that. I work with young people a lot, and you said you missed a lot of the signs, a lot of the things that were happening that you were mistaking as good qualities. Love bombing is, you know, the term that folks currently use. You were in that situation for quite some time. So I just wonder, you know, what advice would you give to young people in relationships, warning signs, things that maybe they should look out for as young people, things that they might think, you know, equate love or strength or commitment that are really just kind of warning signs that maybe they need to look at things a little bit differently?
For me, it was certainly allowing like these big dramatic gestures, these romantic love gestures to minimize bad behavior that was already happening, to minimize, you know, kind of like cruel talk towards me, obviously at a lower level than I experienced later on. But that I think having, and I think that there's a much greater understanding of what verbal abuse is now, and even an emotional abuse than, or at least I had when I was so young and naive, is that an extreme behavior in one area probably means there's an extreme behavior in another, in another area. That it's, I'm in a long-term relationship now and I don't get love bombed. You know, my partner loves me and, you know, I love him every day, but he doesn't come up with crazy, weird gestures either to make up for something or in advance of something bad that's about to happen. So for young people, that the bad moments, you know, really can't be undone by big dramatic, you know, here's some fancy perfume. And right. So it's, you want to, like in movies, you want to believe that that's true, but I don't think it is that often.
What is one thing that kept you going on your journey, even when you were faced with the obstacles or the things that you were going through at that time, where you said some people did not continue in your life or in your kids' life? So what was one thing that you feel that kept you going?
I mean, it was my kids entirely. It was knowing that my ex-husband took off and it was on me, which is a scary thought, but I really absorbed that. And like, I have to be the parent. I have to be the mature one. I have to make the good decisions. I have to look out for them and keep them safe. And that additional sense of responsibility, good and bad, as any single parent knows, it's like, you got to be the good cop and the bad cop. And sometimes you're just a bad cop and you never get to say, it's okay, your mom's acting crazy right now. You still just have to stay on it. But it was knowing that it was on me, and it's a lot of responsibility. But that my daughter said a couple weeks ago, we were talking about her childhood, and she was like, well, you did this and that. And I said, well, what kind of parent do you think I was? And she said, and I'm so proud of this, she said, you're a principled parent. Everything you did was because of your principles and your values. And that probably meant more to me than anything.
Thank you. I know we're running close to time, and I wanted to take the time to say thank you again, Kim, for sharing your story. Thank you for reminding us that reaching our goals is always possible, no matter the obstacles that we may face, and that your journey that may start one way, it's okay for that path or that journey to change. It doesn't mean that you still won't be able to reach the goals. And the village, the support system that you mentioned in your story is very important. So, you know, to the audience, find those friends, that family, organizations in your community that can lend a helping hand. It's okay to ask for help when you need the help, and know that we're all here to support you to make sure that you can reach your goals. Tiffany, any other words to bring to us before we close out?
Well, Kim, I just want to say thank you for sharing your truth, your vulnerability, your weaknesses. I think that is something that we can all grow and learn from. A lot of times people feel like they're defined by their weakest moments, but some of those weakest moments create the strongest people. So I appreciate all that you've offered and shared with us. And I hope that your story can be an inspiration to those who are hearing it today.
Thank you, Tiffany. That's well said.
Yes. And I wanted to take the time to say, and I don't know if it's the right thing to say, but congratulations to you, Kim, when you talked about your sobriety. That's a milestone, and I don't want that to be overlooked. Congratulations to you for standing strong. And that's something that, you know, you should be proud of and always mention. I think that's an amazing thing to tell that piece of your story as well.
Thank you. Well, that was a quick awareness. I need to get myself together.
Well, I wanted to close out with a quote, and it's something that I read. And then when I was talking about this podcast topic, I just felt like it resonated with us. But it says, you will face many defeats in your life, but never let yourself be defeated. And so I just wanted to share that with everyone. You faced a lot in your life, Kim, but you pushed through, you kept your kids number one, and you did what you needed to do, and you leaned on your support. And you're an amazing person. You're a strong woman. You are doing wonderful things in the community, and I'm excited to see what more you bring.
Thank you, Gigi. And we all are. I mean, that's every woman I've ever met that I've helped or has helped me. Just the world is filled with just amazing, open-hearted people.
Thank you. Well, you guys enjoy yourself today. Go out, have some fun. And thank you again for being with us today. And thank you, Tiffany, for hosting with me.
Thank you.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.